I'd be brave as a blizzard.
I'd be gentle as a lizard.
I'd be clever as a gizzard.
If the wizard is a wizard who will serve,
then I'm sure to get a brain,
a heart,
a home,
the knife.
Hello and welcome once again to The Cinephiles, where we are continuing our journey down the yellow brick road to Oz. My name is Steve Morris. I'm a filmmaker and directing instructor in Los Angeles, California.
Hello, everyone. My name is John Rocha. I'm a writer, producer, and host and voiceover actor here in San Diego, California, and really excited to be finally getting on the yellow brick road here in part two of our discussion of The Wizard of Oz, Steve.
And we've been talking about this movie forever. It's one of the great films of all time. It's one of the most important films of all time. But it was really our advisory board on patreon.com/thecinephiles that said, guys, come on, you got to do Wizard of Oz. And of course, they were absolutely right. And you too can help plot the future of the Cinephiles or listen to ad-free versions of the show and as well as our Cinephile shorts that we put out every week by going to patreon.com/thecinephiles. And some of those benefits, but no advisory board, is also on Apple Podcasts.
Absolutely. And of course, another way you can support us on the show is if you listen to us and you don't do the ad-free versions and you hear the ads, if you listen to a product or a service that you want to use and you're intrigued and curious, especially like Uncommon Goods or Washington Red Raspberries, those are good stuff, or True Diagnostics. Whoever, all the sponsors that we've had recently, Uncommon Goods is a great one right now for gifts and what have you, then remember to use our code. And because when you use our code, you get big discounts. And you also indicate to these people who support us that they should keep coming back and support us every month and put their commercials on our show. So that's another way you can make sure we keep going here on The Cinephiles.
And thank you to everyone who supports us in those ways. We could not make the show without you. And where we left off, we had flown to Oz in a twister, killed the Wicked Witch of the East, got the Ruby Slippers, threatened by the Wicked Witch of the West, and now we've marched off on the yellow brick road to find the wizard, and we've arrived at a crossroads.
Who is sitting at the crossroads, Steve?
Well, there's this scarecrow sitting up on a stick there, and I also go, it's like, so you just sent this little girl off on a road and just said, just follow it. Didn't give her any directions, no advice whatsoever. We don't know if she has food. She doesn't have water. She's like, go ahead. You'll be fine.
I think this always matters when you watch the movie, right? Because when we're kids, we're like, we're off on an adventure.
Yeah,
right?
Totally.
It's exciting. We've been given some agency at a young age. But when you're an adult, you're watching this going like, what's the logic behind all of this? Why would you let this happen, Glinda? You know?
I mean, the thing is, and I know we've said this many times on the show, is that, I mean, I care about things making sense. And when I am writing and when I'm teaching writers, I'm always like, that doesn't make sense. Why do they do that? That is very important, except when it's not. The Wizard of Oz does not make sense. Look, it just, you know, like there are more things, particularly when we get to the wizard, I have some things that are like, wait, what's going on here? It doesn't matter. Like, we're here for Oz. We're here for the joy and it's Oz. You know, and so, yes, I will continue to point out things that seem a little odd, but it's not a criticism because this is Oz, you know?
Now which way do we go?
Pardon me. That way is a very nice way.
And she looks up at the scarecrow and he ain't moving. It's a classic bit, you know? Yeah. And this is so much what we see. I think this is vaudeville.
Yeah, 100%.
And there's something, what's so interesting, I think Baum does this in the book, and then the movie does it too, which is that we're going to the fantasy land where everything is different, except everything is recognizably American, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Great point.
By the way, this scene was shot at two different times under two different directors.
Oh.
And Dorothy's hair is at different lengths in different parts of the shooting because it was shot at different times. So you can kind of, if you really look carefully, you can kind of figure out which one was from which take.
If only they shot it in that blue light like they did with Top Gun when they brought Cruise and Kelly McGillis back. They should have done that in the shadows.
I think that's a brilliant plan.
Who said that? Don't be silly, Toto. Scarecrows don't talk.
It's pleasant down that way, too.
He switches. I love the point the left, point the right, and then point crossed arms in both directions.
Wasn't he pointing the other way?
Of course, people do go both ways.
As a kid, that cracked me up.
Why, you did say something, didn't you?
And again, it's all of this, it's still the same gag, which is first he pointed one way and the other and then both ways, and now he shakes his head, nods his head, shakes his head, both ways, you know.
Are you doing that on purpose? Or can't you make up your mind?
That's the trouble. I can't make up my mind. I haven't got a brain. Only straw.
Maybe I'll ask you this later, but I'm going to put the question in your brain. I'm very curious who your favorite of Dorothy's companions are.
Ooh, that's a great question. I have an answer, but we can wait if you want, for sure. But I love the Scarecrow, and I love this beginning with this, because A, you're taking advantage, and we're going to talk about Ray Bolger in a second, but this is what he was known for, his limberness, right? And so seeing his arms go one way or the other, and then cross... And then seeing the way he's just kind of moving his body, even stuck on a pole, you can tell that this is a very limber actor who can use his body to convey certain emotions and certain comedic moments, you know?
How can you talk if you haven't got a brain?
I don't know. But some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
That was for the adults in the crowd.
It's such a Mark Twain line, don't you think? Yeah. Like, it's so in that sense of humor.
We haven't really met properly, have we?
Why, no.
How do you do?
How do you do?
I think this is one of Dorothy's superpowers, is that whatever the weirdness happens, she's still the polite girl from Kansas who was raised right. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, good point. And also, because she's a child, these kind of fantastical moments have a kind of magic to them, as opposed to skepticism, right? She's much more accepting of this stuff than necessarily resistant the whole time.
Oh, dear, that must be terribly uncomfortable. Can't you get down?
Down? No, you see, I'm...
Oh, well, here, let me help you.
And then she goes and helps him down. And he immediately falls, and that's when we see exactly what you're talking about, is every time he moves, he has a way of moving that is the Scarecrow. As much as I feel bad for Buddy Epson, I think he's right. Ray Bolger was supposed to play the Scarecrow.
We should talk about the costume here, right? I mean, like, it's a very amazing costume. Like, just the design of it all. And it's obviously a Scarecrow energy and reminiscent of Scarecrow, but it's also a much more relatable kind of approach to it by having the sack just kind of come out a little bit on the edges of his neck, the rope tied around him, the hat flopping down, the brown nose. Like, just all of it is so well constructed. Plus the way his tunic or blouse, whatever you want to say, his shirt, front shirt is, and then his pants it's such a great design for the Scarecrow, so that you yourself are not afraid of the Scarecrow, and you understand when he's about to tell us how he can't scare anybody. Well, yeah, because he doesn't look like a Scarecrow that could scare anybody, and so he's supposed to be like a childlike, something a child would enjoy, you know, or want to know. And I love that with the design of the costume.
I'm so glad you pointed this out, because the other thing I think about, it's also like the texture of his skin on his face has that feeling of it's a sack.
Yes.
And there's a couple of things about it. One is that this is 1939. Like, they don't have all the latex and technology and molds and materials and all the stuff, not to mention computers and things that we have today to pull off something like this. So this is really impressive with that technology. And the other thing, again, we talk about iconic images like Dorothy and the Witch. When you picture a Scarecrow, do you picture any other Scarecrow than this one?
No, you're right. 100%. Since I was a child. They say a Scarecrow, I immediately think of Wizard of Oz. Yeah.
When he falls, she runs to him and he goes,
"Did I scare you?"
No. I just thought you hurt yourself.
But I didn't scare you?
No, of course not.
I didn't think so.
And then a crow lands on him.
This is great. What a great gag.
John, I know you tend to handle the casting and the actors. Mm. Did you happen to look into The Crow?
No, I did not. There was nothing. But I think it's the great grandfather of the crow we see in The Crow. So, you know, there's a lot.
Well, there you go.
These murder of crows, so to speak.
So the only reason I knew this is because it had come up before on The Cinephiles, which is this is Jimmy the Crow. Jimmy the Crow has been in not one, not two, not three, but now four Cinephiles movies.
What?
He's the crow in It's a Wonderful Life.
Oh, wow.
He shows up in The Adventures of Robin Hood, and he shows up in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Wow. Jimmy was working. Wow.
Yeah, he's also in Saboteur, Meet John Doe, Son of Dracula, You Can't Take It With You. Wow. which, by the way, you can't take it with me with you, is my secret. It's not a guilty pleasure, but it is my favorite Frank Capra movie that nobody talks about.
Wow. Yeah,
I love that one.
Never seen that one. So I should put that on the list for this Christmas for sure.
It is such a, I'm confident you will love it.
Okay.
It has many elements of movies that I already know you love. Hmm. And it has Lionel Barrymore playing as opposite a character as you could possibly play from Mr. Potter. He is the nicest, most lovely, wonderful, joyful person you could possibly imagine.
I love that George Bailey. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I can't even scare a crow. They come from miles around just to eat in my field and laugh in my face. Oh, I'm a failure because I haven't got a brain.
The fact that he thinks he's failing to scare crows because he hasn't got a brain might be the only not smart thing that the scarecrow says in the entire movie, I think.
But the fact that he even has a hypothesis or a thesis for why he thinks this stuff is happening shows that he's got a brain, because he's had these thoughts, you know, and you can't think if you don't have a brain.
What would you do with a brain if you had one?
Do? Why, if I had a brain, I could...
This is my favorite song.
I could while away the hours, conferring with the flowers, consulting with the rain. And my head, I'd be scratching while my thoughts were busy hatching if I only had a brain.
You know when a song gets stuck in your head and you're like, oh, God, I hate this.
Right.
If I only had a brain, gets stuck in my head all the time. And you know what I do? I start whistling it because it makes me happy. I just really like this song.
Yeah.
And I love Ray Bolger in it. I love the rhyme schemes. And what's funny is with this song is that we essentially get three versions of the same song. Mm-hmm. Because we've only had some brain, courage, a heart, it's going to be similar. But each one is orchestrated differently, each one is performed differently, and each one is filmed differently.
I would not be just a nuffin, my head all full of stuffin, my heart all full of pain. I would dance and be merry, life would be a ding-a-dairy if I only had a brain.
The dance we get as he's singing the song, which is such an amazing dance, obviously played into Ray Bolger's strengths, because he was known for his, as I said, limber body, but improvisational dance movements. You know, the guy who came from vaudeville, had his own show later in life. He was in Babes in Toyland. And so he had a great energy to him as a performer. Out of vaudeville, all the stuff that he did. So he just had a natural energy to play a character like this. You immediately love him and you immediately have a smile on your face. And I don't care what age you watch this movie, when you watch this sequence, I challenge you not to regress to being a child watching for the first time, because it's just so magical and sweet, you know, and their chemistry and their back and forth as he's dancing around, and the little physical gags of the leaning one way or another, those things are just so great to see with the Scarecrow.
They're fantastic. And I want to point out, I know I mentioned this a little bit before, Kip Yarbrough, who's the lyricist, he does this thing, he does it throughout, and I'm just going to point out one example of it, which is that, as anyone who has listened to music knows, there's a certain amount of time per each bar, and there's a rhyme scheme, and the number of syllables have to fit correctly into the musical rhythm and the rhyming scheme in order for it to work. And in general, a sign of bad songwriting is when you cheat. You know, I couldn't quite make this rhyme work, but I'm gonna just push it through anyway.
Yeah.
Kip Harbaugh, he turns that into a benefit. That it is a feature, not a bug. So you get a line like,
I'd unravel every riddle for any individual in trouble or in pain.
Now the word is individual, but that doesn't fit in the rhyme scheme. So he changes it to individual. He does this constantly, all the time, just playing with the words. And what happens is it's kind of joyful. Instead of feeling like a mistake, I couldn't make this work, it feels like I'm playing with language in this really fun way.
Yeah, agreed.
They filmed a much longer dance number here, and it was cut out of the movie. And I've seen little clips of it. I'm not sure that I've ever seen the whole thing or if it even still exists. Right. It looked really cool.
Yeah, of course, because it's Ray Bolger. You know, I mean, why wouldn't you enjoy more of him? But, you know, you got to cut it to fit the time you want to get to the next thing as well. And I do want to say one more thing about Ray Bolger. Remember that Dr. Pepper commercial that he did in the 1980s, the dancing commercial? Do you remember that one? Him and Liza Minnelli, they did that. And then, his commercial. And then he did a film with Liza Minnelli, a special there, That's Dancing. And then he even won a Tony Award. So this is a guy who had a lot of credits and remained in the public eye, remained an entertainer for his entire life. He was even Shirley Jones's dad in the Partridge Family. So, you know, this guy had a, and I remember him on Love Boat, Fantasy Island, so many great things. So not just a song and dance man, he could also play drama. He could also play these kind of moving roles, especially as he got older. So he just had one of those great faces of old Hollywood that kept working all the way until his passing. So I love that about him.
You're going to see a wizard? Do you think if I went with you, this wizard would give me some brains?
I couldn't say. But even if he didn't, you'd be no worse off than you are now.
The structure of this movie is so crystal clear.
Yep.
You get to this next place. Okay, this person's joining you to get, this is what they want.
Yep.
This is what the obstacle is.
Well, let me ask you though, Steve, get your big brain working on this. What's the symbolism of starting off with the Scarecrow? What's the logic in starting off with the Scarecrow? Are we supposed to love him the most? Because Dorothy does by the end. Remember, Dorothy hugs him at the end and says, I'm going to miss you the most. So,
which I always feel bad for the other two guys. It's like, Sidney's like, I'm standing right here. I'm right here. Come on, man.
It's always the firstborn. You know this. It's because it's such a great commentary. You said the Mark Twain stuff is such a great reference to put on this interaction, you know, like, because there's some little comments and asides, but there's also this idea of, you know, you don't have value unless you're smart, right? And there's a commentary in that, which I think is bubbling below the surface in all of this. Because I think all of these characters we're about to meet represent a cross-section of people in life or thoughts that people have had in life. And so it's a way of accepting, it's a funny way of accepting people for who they are instead of sitting in a place of like, well, I don't have worth because I don't have this. And it's pushing back on that analogy. And a lot of us, even now in 2025, feel this way, right? I don't have that extra bit of money or that extra bit of intelligence or that extra bit of, you know, empathy or sympathy or all these things and or courage, right? We're going to get to that. And I think it's a fascinating gift of the movie that it says to you, you've always had it. You just have to believe you have it. And that's the key to it all. And you're not in deficiency because you think you don't have it. You still have value. And I always find that watching it this time, I felt like that very strongly as I was watching the movie, you know?
I'm really glad you asked this question. And it's funny because there is something I was going to say at the end that I'll actually say here, which is that the rewards with the wizard in the book are not the same as what they are in the movie.
Oh.
What's interesting about what you're saying is because you know the movie, and the movie is the thing you're missing is a diploma, which is about external validation.
Right.
And in the book, what he says is that knowledge is about experience, and you were only born really recently, but see how much you've learned in this time.
Mm.
So, and then he says, but if it would make you feel better, I'll stuff some sand or something in your head so you feel like you have a brain.
Right.
But the message is actually about experience versus, whereas the message in The Wizard of Oz is about external validation.
Right.
It's a different message. And so the reason I wanted to bring it up here is, and I hadn't thought about it until you asked the question that way, but like I have always been bothered, and you and I've had this conversation about the difference, but about people thinking that highly educated people are therefore more intelligent.
Mm.
And they're not. They're well educated. So like intelligence, there are all sorts of people that, you know, never finished high school that are ridiculously smart, but because of circumstances, they didn't get anywhere. And I actually think starting with this person who is the smartest person in the movie, let's be real clear, almost all the good ideas come from the Scarecrow.
Yeah, it's true.
But he doesn't believe. I think this is about class. I think this is about the uneducated man and the educated man. And the Scarecrow goes, what's wrong with me? I'm obviously, and he's a working class guy.
Right.
Like the problem with me is I don't have brains, you know, and that, and the thing is saying I don't have brains is an internal problem. Seeing, you know, like there's something wrong with me. I am deficient as opposed to I don't have education. That's an external problem. So like, that's actually what I really think about the Scarecrow. Like, I think the Scarecrow is a genius who hasn't had the opportunity to show off his geniusness, you know?
Right. Because he's bought into the lie that he's not smart or that he doesn't have a brain.
Exactly.
And we don't know who gave him that lie. We never find out, right, who told him that and that he believed it, and then held on to it all the way through until that moment. And you talk about external versus internal, like what you see in the book. I think it makes sense because it's a visual medium. So you want to show the audience, okay, signify or a diploma, signify a medal with a heart on it. Like these little things that are signifiers work for the film, as opposed to a book where I think it's not a visual medium in that way. And so I think that the idea of a bag of sand in the head works for that particular approach to the story. So I like that they adjusted it. Even though it does, I can see the point of like, well, they're essentially saying you need external validation when you really don't.
I don't think they were thinking that way. They want to make a good movie, but they weren't thinking that 90 years later, you and I would be sitting here analyzing. They just like, this will be fun. They wanted to make something fun, you know? Yeah. And same with L. Frank. I do think L. Frank Baum had messages and there were things he was thinking about, but mostly he was thinking about delight and fun. Yeah. You know, that's his main job. Hi, Cinephiles fans. You know, sometimes when I'm prepping for a show, I get an undeniable urge for something sweet. And lately, my go-to has been Washington Red Raspberries. Now, if you've been listening to this show, you already know that Washington Red Raspberries are frozen at the peak of freshness by passionate farmers in Washington State. But what you might not know is how to make a delicious mini crumble in under 15 minutes. So here's my shoot from the hip recipe. Grab a couple of handfuls of frozen raspberries and throw them in the microwave just long enough to get them warm. Probably less than a minute. Toss in a few tablespoons of sugar, a squeeze of lemon juice, and a bit of cornstarch. Give it a taste and adjust the sweetness. In a separate bowl, mash together some oats, flour, butter, brown sugar, cinnamon, and a pinch of salt. I'd give that a taste too, but all combos of butter and carbs and sugar are going to taste pretty good. Spread that on top of your berries in a container that can stand up to air fryer temperatures. I have a tiny cast iron skillet that works perfectly. Then throw the whole thing in your air fryer at 400 degrees, and between 6 and 10 minutes later, you will have a beautiful raspberry crumble that can only be improved by a scoop of vanilla ice cream. Now, Washington Red Raspberries have been specially developed to be frozen, which means they can survive freezing and microwaving, air frying, and still maintain great texture, color, and flavor. And I can confirm that they are particularly delicious when eaten while watching a great film. Washington Red Raspberries are available in the freezer section at places like Costco, Kroger, and Winco Foods. Make sure to look for Product of the U.S. on the bag, and happy cooking.
Hey, Cinephiles fans, the holidays are almost here, and if you still have names on your list, don't panic. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. You'll discover presents that feel meaningful and personal, never rushed or last minute. You know, right now it's Oscar season with all these films coming out that are vying for nominations next year, and I went to the Uncommon Goods website, and they have this incredible book that you can give as a gift. It's called The History of the Oscars. From the LA Times here, it features 250 plus pages of original Oscar coverage from 1929 to the present, and you can personalize it with a name on the cover and a heartfelt message inside at no extra cost for that film lover on your list. Uncommon Goods has something for everyone, though, and with every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give back $1 to a nonprofit partner of your choice. So don't wait. Make this holiday the year you give something truly unforgettable. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/cinephiles. That's uncommongoods.com/CINEFILES for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary. So, Steve, it looks like we have a new sponsor on the Cinephiles, and I understand you've gotten some good use out of them.
Dude, since we've been working with Secret Nature, my sleep's been better, my stress level is down, and I've been more productive.
Wow, that sounds like a major change knowing you.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, between the podcast, being a dad, and the world, I wasn't exactly in top form. But when I tried the Secret Nature Daytime Gummy, I got like a clean, cool feeling. I mean, I could feel my shoulders literally dropping down a couple of inches, and I was able to stop focusing on a whole bunch of things I couldn't control and sit down to deal with some of the things I could.
That's fantastic. I know a lot of people would love to feel this way. And your sleep is better too?
Oh yeah. I used to wake up all the time and not be able to get back to sleep. But Secret Nature has a great nighttime gummy that not only helps me sleep through the night, but I am waking up refreshed and focused.
That's great, brother. I love that. And if you all want to try Secret Nature gummies, you can get 30% off your first order at secretnature.com with the code CINEFILES. That's secretnature.com, code CINEFILES. Try them out today.
Dorothy, I believe, puts out a complete and full disclosure about anyone wanting to participate in anything with her because she says,
I've got a witch mad at me and you might get into trouble.
Witch? I'm not afraid of a witch. I'm not afraid of anything. Except a lighted match.
It's plans and payoffs. It's a very well-structured screenplay.
100%.
And this is this other structural element is that with each section is going to end with, we're back off to see the wizard.
To Oz?
To Oz.
We're off to see the wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz. We hear he is the wizard of a wiz, if ever a wiz there was. If ever, oh, ever a wiz there was, the Wizard of Oz has won because of the wonderful things he does.
They're coming over a hill towards an apple tree, and I don't know if you have this memory, but my memory as a kid is that when I was watching it each year, sometimes there were scenes that were there, and sometimes there were scenes that were not. And this apple tree scene was one that wasn't always in the movie.
Yeah, I agree with that. I remember that. I don't remember that when I first watched the movie. I do remember it years later, like on TNT, right, seeing the scene with the apples and the tree. I agree with that.
And the reason is because for time and commercial length, they were continually adjusting this film as it played every year. So every year it's like, wait, wasn't there something else here?
Yeah.
But Dorothy is hungry, goes to get an apple, slapped by the tree.
Ouch!
What do you think you're doing?
We've been walking a long ways and I was hungry and... Did you say something?
I think I told you I recently reread all of the Oz books or listened to them.
Yeah.
They're not that long, and I listen to things at very high speed. L. Frank Baum's, what he really does the most is transforming things that are ordinary into things that are alive, you know? So there's a sawhorse that becomes someone's horse to ride. There's, you know, the patchwork girl. There's, like, just all these things become animated in L. Frank Baum's world. Well, and I think in this is a real key insight from Baum about how children see the world. Because if you hang out with little kids, 2, 3, 4, 5 years old,
right,
everything is alive. Their blankie is alive. Their stuffed animal is alive. They name everything. They'll pull out the pots and pans and have conversations with the pots and pans. And so making things alive that aren't normally alive is perfect communication to the child mind.
Yeah, I mean, we see them, like, that's how they come up with fantasy friends, right? And things of that
exactly.
nature. So, this is how they play. Everything has a personality.
And I think, by the way, probably every parent, at least every parent with an imaginative kid, has had a moment where they're having a conversation with their five-year-old and go, is my child insane? Are they full? Like, do I have to be worried about this?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, my son was I was talking to his doppelganger because he was the robot that had been possessed by a demon and the real Jackson was actually in this other place. And that was the conversation we had for a lot. I'm like, does he really think this? Or is this, are we playing yes and? And it's very hard to tell. And the tree gets mad and starts throwing apples at them.
Yeah, I love this.
It's the first example of the scarecrow using his brains.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love the voice characterization. Hey, what are you talking about?
Totally.
You know, like my apples. Well, I don't, you know, first he didn't want to give them up. Then he's like, how can you don't insult the things that I didn't want to give you anyway. So it's hilarious.
So the trees throw apples at them and Dorothy is rushing around picking them up and she comes across a metal foot.
Why, it's a man made out of tin.
And this is Jack Haley.
Jack Haley, what a fantastic performer here for many years. He was a comedian, he was a dancer, he was a radio host, he was a singer, and he was a drummer. And of course, coming out of vaudeville himself out of Boston, Massachusetts here. He worked with Sinatra, Shirley Temple through the years as well. Lucille Ball on a number of things. Came back to do musicals in the 1940s and replaced Buddy Ebsen as the Tin Man because Buddy had suffered an allergic reaction after inhaling aluminum powder from his silver face makeup. So for Haley to avoid the same problem, the dust was converted into paste and the paste caused an eye infection. Haley anyway, and he was out for 4 shooting days. So this was, as you said earlier, Steve, in the first part, I think, this was a tough, oh no, actually you just said this a few minutes ago. This is a tough on the actors, this makeup and this, all this stuff that they're dealing with. And we'll get to, of course, Margaret Hamilton a little bit later. But yeah, all of this stuff combined for him. But he was a wonderful performer. And you asked earlier, what's your favorite character? This is my favorite character of the three. I love the Tin Man.
I would never have predicted the Tin Man would be. What is it about the Tin Man, do you think?
I just think, you know, for as gregarious or outgoing as I am sometimes, when I'm by myself, I am the Tin Man. I am kind of sometimes a little scared, sometimes a little nervous about stuff, sometimes, you know, not sure if I have the heart to go through with things, you know? So a lot of that I connect to. And I love Jack Haley's performance. To me, it's like a raindrop dancing on top of a thin wire. The way he speaks, the way he sings this song. And I'm kind of a romantic. And so you might not believe that with a brace, as abrasive as I can be sometimes, but I'm absolutely a hopeless romantic. And so the way he sings some of the stuff, some of the lyrics here, "Wherefore art thou, Romeo?" You know, these little things like that, I think are great. And so I just love him for that, you know. And the Scarecrow is great. And the Cowardly Lion is so much fun. But the Tin Man is who I would love to play if I was to ever do this as an actor.
By the way, the "Wherefore art thou, Romeo?" That yeah. is, and I don't have her name in front of me, but that is Snow White. That is the voice of Snow White.
Oh, that's great. I had no idea. Oh, well.
He's an oil can.
And they start oiling him, and first his mouth, and he says,
My goodness, I can talk again. Oh, oil my arms, please. Oil my elbows.
I agree with you. Jack Haley has a warmth to it, yes. You know. Yeah.
There's a softness in his delivery. That's great.
And he tells the story about how he was chopping trees and it began to rain. The story in the book is much more brutal. He's in love with someone and they enchant. Someone doesn't want him to marry that person, so they enchant his axe. So one by one, it chops his limbs off.
Damn.
And each one gets replaced by tin until he is completely a tin man.
Jesus.
Yeah.
You're perfect now.
Perfect? Oh, bang on my chest if you think I'm perfect. Beautiful. What a nickel. It's empty. The tinsmith forgot to give me a heart.
I just love it. I'm sorry. I just love the delivery. I love it's empty. See? There's just this real kind of softness and matter-of-factness, but I immediately have sympathy and empathy for him, and I'm drawn to him so well.
I think I've commented on this before, but it's always when we're doing, there's a difference between movies that are deep in my DNA that I've seen many, many, many times and movies that I've seen, you know, so Blair Witch I had seen.
Right.
But I can't hear the delivery of the lines in my head the way I can with Wizard of Oz, you know?
Yeah.
And this, by the way, another thing about Tin Man, I think this is directly connected to Baum growing up in the world after the Civil War.
Oh.
Because he saw all these men with mechanical limbs, with hooks for hands, with wounds, and thought a lot about what that is to be less than what you were, you know?
Right.
And the other thing about it is we're entering into the industrial age and men are going to the factory. And Baum, in an interview once said, "In Oz, the Tin Woodman represents the human worker, once flesh and blood turned into a machine through his labor."
Oh. Wow.
Deep, huh?
So interesting. So would the Scarecrow be like the intellectual, the college kid, the intellectual? The Tin Man is the blue collar worker. Interesting.
Who maybe, who's maybe drafted to be a soldier and be part of the military machine, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And the idea of, well, where do we get our humanity from? When you move from the fields to the factory and now you're just really a machine that's feeding the machine.
Right.
Are you still human? Do you have a heart?
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Or do you just do what you're told? Do you just follow orders? Or do you have a heart? Yeah.
I'd be tender. I'd be gentle. And awful sentimental regarding love and art. I'd be friends with the sparrows and the boy who shoots the arrows if I only had a heart.
And again, as I mentioned, like the tempo is different, the orchestration is different, the filming is different. We're in close. It's very soft. It's very kind of warm and comforting the way this is done.
And I mean, the lyrics are so fascinating because he's talking about, again, being human. Right. So I think what I had never thought of it from the prism of soldiers that have experienced these things and I mean, because I imagine it must have been a colossal mindfuck to have mechanical parts replace your limbs. And we see that in The Best Years of Our Lives, of course, as well, as an element of that, because that gentleman actually had that happen to him. So the things he's talking about, I think, are phenomenal. In the man's an empty kettle. I could be human if I only had a heart. And then he gets into the softer stuff, right? The stuff about art, the stuff about music, the boy who shoots the arrows, the sparrows, this kind of stuff. And I love the ending, just to register emotion, jealousy, devotion, and really feel the part. I could stay young and chipper, and I'd lock it with a zipper if I only had a heart. So there's a kind of preciousness to it for him. And he thinks that's all he needs to finally be human. And it's ironic. He's a man made of tin, you know, yeah. And he thinks the heart is the difference, or is the missing piece, you know.
And like the Scarecrow, he's the most compassionate character in the film. So he's not missing anything.
No, he's not. No, right.
You know, like that's the lovely thing about this story. Yeah. I definitely think, you know, it's not that I think that the Wizard of Oz is, I don't want to say it. I think it's tough because I don't think that you have to think that the Wizard of Oz is a deep and profound movie to love the Wizard of Oz.
You don't have to.
That's not the point. Like, right. I do think there are things to be found here. And I think, you know, and it's usually true when something, particularly with children,
yes,
really, really hooks into them and then hooks into us as family and stuff, like, there probably is a little bit more there to be found, you know?
Yeah. Again, that's not our show. Our show is not, we really love the movie. Thanks for listening, right, Everybody. Take care of yourselves. Our show is looking a little bit deeper. And so I'm always fascinated by people who listen to our show and go, you guys are looking way too deep. And it's like, that's the show. And so, yes. It's
did you notice it was that our episodes were like 7 hours long? You think we can go shallow?
It's like going to Ken Burns. Ken, you talk about this stuff too much. Look, it just happened. It was a battle. Let's move on. You know, that's not how this works. And so always the foundation is our enjoyment of the movie. That is always the foundation. And if you stripped all our stuff down, that's what we are at the base. But building upon the foundation, we create these massive buildings from our conversations and analysis of the movie. I don't mind people disagreeing with our analysis, but when people go, you're going too far, you're going too deep, I just go, you're listening to the wrong show.
If that's
you know, yeah.
That's where you're just like, hey, thank you very much for your patronage. Maybe you should seek out a different podcast.
Yeah, one that's 20 minutes long on the movie.
Yeah. There's a lot of movie podcasts competing for your time. Pick the right one. And just as we totally enjoyed the Scarecrow specific way of dancing, the Tin Man has his own way of moving that, of course, the peak of it is when he does that little, you know, drum solo on his body, culminating with the toot toot out of his head. I mean, that's awesome.
Also, I love the lean standing still where they don't know if he's going to fall over, you know, running to the left and to the right of him, which is what Michael Jackson stole.
Yep.
For Smooth Criminal when he has that move. So that is all from the Tin Man and Wizard of Oz, which I think he said in numerous interviews.
Well, and this is, you know, I talked about how L. Frank Baum was fascinated with these basic stage magic tricks. This is a classic old school. I bet they use this particular trick in Shakespeare, which is all it is that you have a boot with a hole in the heel, and there's a peg coming out of the stage. And when you step down, you step onto that peg, and now you've essentially locked your very, very sturdy boots into the ground so that you can lean on them. It's a great effect.
Yes, 100%.
Naturally, they offer him the same offer as the Scarecrow. Come with us to see the wizard. And when the subject first came up with the Scarecrow, her attitude was like, well, I don't know if he can give you a brain, but you're not going to be any worse off. Right. At this point, she has bought in.
Well, suppose the wizard wouldn't give me one when we got there.
Oh, but he will. He must. We've come such a long way already.
And that is her faith. She has been building faith in the wizard with no evidence.
Yeah, none. You know. And as more people come aboard, to her, she gets caught up in it. Like, oh, no, this has got to be the right thing. Look at all these people that have the same common issue. They're missing something. And I think now we're all in league. So it has to be coming true. It has to be a real thing. So
I love that. And they're dependent upon her. Yes. She got them to do this. So if it's not a real thing, that's her fault.
Well, I don't know about all that, but yes.
Well, let me put it differently. She might feel responsible. I would certainly feel responsible.
Right.
And then we hear that laugh, man. And this moment with the Wicked Witch of the West, I don't know why this was the scariest moment of the movie to me. When she pops up on that house, again, I'm behind the couch. Tell me when it's over. Scared the crap out of me.
Out of that red smoke.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's because we've just started to feel good. Like we've started in the movie and the pacing of the film. We're in that place. I'm like, okay, now Scarecrow's on board. Now the Tin Man's on board. And like we're ready to go. And then boom, here she comes. So it's smart placement.
Helping the little lady along, are you, my fine gentleman? Well, stay away from her. Or I'll stuff a mattress with you. And you, I'll use you for a behind. Here, Scarecrow. Wanna play ball?
And shoots a fireball at the Scarecrow, who goes down screaming. This is a scary scene, man.
Yeah.
And she disappears in that amazing cloud of red smoke.
I'm not afraid of her. I'll see you get safely to the wizard now, whether I get a brain or not.
So I have to confess that there was one time they were playing The Wizard of Oz at the Chinese Theater in Hollywood.
Yes.
And I went to see it, and I was very high.
Oh,
and
okay.
I started just watching, particularly Jack Haley, but watching the three, you know, the Tin Man, the Scarecrow, and the Lion in the background. There is so much stuff they're doing. And of course, I was very high, but I was like, oh my God, this is an entirely different movie if you just watch what they're doing in the background.
I feel as if I've known you all the time, but I couldn't have, could I?
I don't see how. You weren't around when I was stuffed and sewn together, were you?
And I was standing over there rusting for the longest time.
Well, let me ask you this question. Okay, because we started watching this as little kids, probably younger than we can remember.
Yes.
Was there a point that you realized that you had already met these guys?
No. Not until the end of the movie.
Yeah.
As a kid, I did not make the connection. That it was because you really don't have a lot of time with the three guys at the beginning of the movie. If we had had more time with them, like having multiple scenes with them and Dorothy, I think that would have been a little more established. So by the time they show up, I'm like, oh, I know what they are. But they're under costume, they're under makeup, heavy makeup, and especially the lion, which we're going to get to. So I had no idea it was the three guys till the end of the movie, you know. And when they come in and the camera makes it very clear, like, do you get it? You know, and so, yeah, I got it as a kid then, but not before.
Oh, it's funny. I was going to ask this question at the end, but it seems an appropriate point to bring up right now, which is Adam McAllister, one of our supporters on Patreon, says, do you believe Oz was a dream? And if so, does it matter to the story's meaning? Reading the novel for the first time, the book displays Oz as a real place, in my opinion, but the movie strongly suggests it's a dream with Dorothy hitting her head in the tornado. What are your thoughts?
Well, I don't think it's either. Because it's not a dream. I don't know what happens when you get knocked out. I've never been knocked out, knock on wood. But I can't imagine I would call that a dream. Whatever's going on when you get knocked out, if you have a vision, I think for me, this is a vision. This is like a, not to make a Native American connection, but she's going on a walkabout in essence. And so to me, that's what this all is. And her mind takes her into these places for whatever reasons. And she comes out the other side with a deeper appreciation of her family and her place, you know, her home. And so, yeah, that's the way I look at it. I don't see it as a dream or as a real thing.
It's such an interesting question because the more I think about it, I think a lot has to do with how you experience the film.
Mm.
And that's why I wanted to bring this up here is that I don't think as a kid I paid very much attention to those characters that I met at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
Like the Tin Man, the Scarecrow, and the Lion are like the most incredibly charismatic, impactful characters.
Yeah.
So when I'm young at this point in the movie, I'm not able to think back and know what the hell she's talking about.
Right.
That's the first thing. And then the second thing is it was all a dream thing. It's not that I thought that was a betrayal as a kid. That was just the movie. But Oz is real. Like, that's my feeling as a child. We went to a real place. You could have someone wake up in a dream or whatever, But like that place is real. And I think that, and to me, so to me, this is the kind of the magic of the film is that, and this is, I swear to God, how I always thought of it. You know, we had to do a short recently on headcanon. This is maybe one of my first examples of headcanon, which is that I just assumed, knew that both things were true. Mm. That she did get knocked out and she was here and she did really go to Oz. That her astral projection or whatever it had to be, because Oz is real, you know? Yeah. And maybe there's some connection. I remember as a kid thinking, oh, well, it's like there's parallel lives like that. You know, like this is an alternate reality in which in this reality, the Scarecrow is this guy Hunk or whatever, or Zeke. Yeah. I don't remember which name's which. But yeah, to me, and this is the, to say that Oz wasn't real, it's not that I think that's a betrayal of the audience. Right. It's that I think Oz is real. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like that's the real thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I respect that. I mean, it's all a matter of how that movie, how you consume the film, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and also, as I said in part one, I had all the books. So once I became 8 or 9, I was reading all the Oz books over and over again. Wow. You know, these are the first books I obsessed about.
Yeah. Wow. Okay.
This Black Friday, get 6 months free when you move your WordPress sites to Kinsta. Enjoy faster load times, no stress when traffic spikes, and hosting you can actually count on. We're G2's number one rated host for WordPress, for a reason. Visit kinsta.com/BF. That's KINSTA.com/BF. Don't miss out. Offer ends December 2nd.
Now we're heading off to see the wizard again. Again, the skip is slightly different.
Yeah.
And we have to talk about one of the great urban myths of the Wizard of Oz, which is as you are heading off to see the wizard, in the background, there's a weird thing that moves. Yeah. And if you watch the 4K version or the Blu-ray version in crystal clear high def, this confusion does not happen. What it is they had basically a big sort of puppet bird in the background flap its wings. But when you watch this on your crappy TV in 1978 and the resolution was super low, people thought, is that a munchkin hanging from a noose in the background of this shot? It is not.
Yeah.
But that legend has been running around for a long time.
I remember learning about that. And I was just like, oh, what? What's going on?
No, there were no suicides on set filmed and included in the movie.
I remember when conspiracy theories used to be fun.
We head into the forest. It's suddenly much spookier. And the thing to keep in mind, the sound design here is great. Like you really, a totally different sound environment. Sound movies are only a decade old. Mm-hmm. So this, you know, when they started doing it, there's all these things about your perception of sound that you don't know about until you make a movie.
Yeah.
And one of them is that, because what our brain does is you and I are having a conversation. And so we naturally amplify internally the sound of the person you're talking to. And we turn down the volume of everything else because we don't want to be distracted by it. There's something called the cocktail party effect. Maybe I've said this on the Cinephiles at some point, which is that if you and I are out, like I had that party at my house recently, if you and I are at that party and it's really loud there, we can totally understand what each other is saying by looking closely at the person, watching their mouth, et cetera. But if I put a camera and a microphone in the exact same position as I was and had it facing and seeing and hearing exactly what I was hearing, and then I watched the video of that, I wouldn't be able to understand what was being said. Because of the way sound works in the brain is that my eyes are helping me filter out sounds in different directions, all these things, or the fact that the sound of my footsteps doesn't sound, the actual sound recorded for my footsteps, when you're also recording my voice, they don't sound right, which is why I record the footsteps separately doing Foley. Like there's all these things of how sound works or the layers of it. Cause like right now there is maybe a fan noise, there's freeway noise, there's bird noise outside my window. There's probably, if I was doing a sound design for this room, there's probably 10, 12 tracks of ambiences that I would layer to make it sound like the real thing. All that is what has been figured out in this first decade of sound pictures, so that by the time we get to this forest, it's a rich sound field where you can feel there are many, many, many tracks of sound that were used to create this moment, you know?
Yeah.
I don't like this forest. It's dark and creepy.
course, I don't know, but I think it'll get darker before it gets lighter.
You know what it just occurred to me. I already said the scariest scene in the movie was the scene we just had where the Wicked Witch showed up. And now you're showing our heroes being really, really scared. Yeah. And I wonder if this made me, as a five-year-old, feel better. I bet it did. Because this scene isn't scary like the witch scene. This is fun scary, you know?
Yeah, I disagree with you. You and I are different approaches. Like, because I thought the witch scene is a funny scene, a funny scary scene, and this scene is legitimately scary.
There you go. I'm so glad you said that.
But of course, again, we all consume the films as we consume them. And so this one was scary because I've been lost in the woods when I was a kid a few times, actually. And so it can get scary. And now as an adult, I love that line that it feels like it's going to get darker before it gets brighter. And I'm like, yeah, all right, I get it. And then we think something, and the way they lead up to it, the chant that we're about to hear, you know, it kind of gets in your head, like, what is going to show up?
Lions and tigers and bears. Oh, my.
Lions and tigers and bears.
Oh, my.
Things like lions and tigers and bears, oh, my. Yeah. It's like a song fragment, you know?
Yeah.
It a few times, but every single person who watches The Wizard of Oz remembers lions and tigers and bears. Oh, my. It is a great shot for the lion's first appearance. He climbs up on a tree, then jumps down, springs off, really good physicality.
Put him up.
Before, I'm sure you have information on Bert Lahr. He was not the original casting choice. Would you like to know who the original casting choice is?
Please.
Well, they have had him on contract at MGM forever, and that is Leo, the lion that roars at the beginning of every movie. They talked about using a real lion in this part.
You fucking insane.
Right? But they chose not to go with an actual lion. They chose not to go with an animated lion, which they discussed at one point. And instead, they went with the great, great Bert Lahr.
Yeah, Bert Lahr. Some people are born to play a role. We talked about Ray Bolger for Scarecrow. And I do love Jack Haley, the Tin Man, obviously. But like, he was born to play this part. He's just so natural in how he comes across. He's just such a great natural comedian. he left school at 15 years old to start doing vaudeville. Let that sink in. Imagine someone coming home and saying, I'm going to go do vaudeville. I'm leaving high school to go do vaudeville. And then eventually debuted on Broadway, did a bunch of shows on Broadway's like Merry-Go-Round, Hold Everything, Flying High, Burlesque, and moved eventually into films and did a few films as well. And then boom, this is the one that is really the massive, and after he got into The Wizard of Oz, and this is a nice little Looney Tunes reference. In 1944, he was in a film called Meet the People, and he was the one who uttered the phrase, Heavens to Murgatroyd, for the first time ever, which was later used by Snagglepuss in the Hanna-Barbera cartoons. So he's got this kind of connection to it in that. And when he was in theater, he was one of the first people to do Waiting for Godot. And so put that in your head. It was performed in Europe, and then he co-starred in the U.S. premiere in 1956 at the Coconut Grove Playhouse in Miami, Florida. And he later reprised it for a short run on Broadway as well. So, yeah, he did that. And then on TV with a number of TV shows like The Fantastics, What's My Line. He was in commercials for Lay's Potato Chips. Then worked with Sinatra and Ethel Merman later in variety hour type of stuff. And then eventually he won the Tony Award for the best leading actor in a musical for his role in the musical Foxy in 1964. So again, yeah, Ray Bolger with a Tony. You've got Bert Lahr with a Tony. I don't think Jack Haley won a Tony, but those two, that's a hell of a lineup. Plus Judy Garland. So yeah, a lot of talent in this cast for sure.
When you first said he was in Godot, my initial reaction was like, the Cowardly Lion? And I went, oh my God, that's great. That's like perfect casting. That would be amazing. Well, and you know, that Beckett loved vaudeville and clowns, and that was his thing. Yeah, so it makes a lot of sense. The composers had worked with him on Broadway, and they always loved him, but he had just never really translated to film. They hadn't found a part. And it sounds a lot like, you know, this is kind of who Bert Lahr was, a big, blustering personality with a super sweet, sensitive, insecure side. you know, like who's a lot of a lot.
Yeah.
By the way, his costume weighs 90 pounds.
Ugh.
It is made out of two real lion skins. That is real lion on the Cowardly Lion. Very claustrophobic. And he was a nervous, fidgety guy. So this was not easy to be in the, and they had to come in, all three of these guys had to come in at 4:30 in the morning. It took four to eight hours, depending on what they were doing exactly, to get them in their makeup. And then they had to work a whole day on a set that we already said was 120 degrees because of all the lights. And you're wearing 90 pounds and doing dancing and all this makeup. And you've been up since 4:30. I mean, this is a brutal gig.
Which one are you afraid? I'll fight you both together if you want. I'll fight you with one paw tied behind my back.
Again, it's American, too, because this is the Bowery Boys. This is the Street Fighter tough guy translated into the King of the Jungle.
Yeah, those things are great. Yeah, and apparently he improvised a lot of his lines as well. He was ad-libbing a lot of his lines in the film as well, which I think is another way you let an actor just shine, who you know has his comedic sensibilities.
Oh, pulling an axe on me, eh? Sneaking up on me, eh?
So I didn't answer my own question. My favorite of the three, of course, is the Scarecrow. I mean, that's who, you know. I relate to the Scarecrow, but I think the greatest performance is the Cowardly Lion.
Well, he's the only one that gets two solo numbers in the movie.
Yeah.
Of the three. The three companions.
Well, and again, those songs, If I Only Had a Brain, they're very short. It's like, you know, two verses and a chorus. If I Were King of the Forest is a full long song.
I love that song. Love
it. It's amazing. And so he is doing what the classic frightened bully does, which is to be overly aggressive in order so no one challenges him and it doesn't get revealed that he's a coward.
Yeah.
I actually think the Cowardly Lion situation is different from the Scarecrow and the Tin Man. The Tin Man unquestionably is the kindest, most loving person in the film.
Right.
And the Scarecrow unquestionably comes up with more good ideas than anybody else.
Yes.
The Lion does have to overcome his fear.
Yes. Well, because I think the other two are ridiculous. Because obviously these are supposed to connect with us as human beings, right? And so, well, no, of course you've got a brain. We're all born with a brain part, right? Courage is something you have to
fight for.
Yeah, fight for or have naturally. There are a lot of people born with courage naturally. And there are people who have to learn how to have courage in life and those things. So you see that is more real. And something I think it's more relatable, you know, for people who are watching the film, which is he's probably one of the most beloved characters in the film. Yeah.
I literally this weekend I had a career not great thing happen, and I had to go. All right, I gotta fight back. I gotta, you know, like that. You know, we deal with whether or not you have courage all the time. All the life is filled with moments where you have to decide if you're going to have courage.
100%. Micro courage moments for sure.
Put your hands up, you lopsided bag of hay.
Now that's getting personal, Lion.
Yes. Get up and teach him a lesson.
Well, what's wrong with you teaching him?
Well, I hardly know him.
This is vaudeville.
Well, that's what I mean about just watch them. Just watch them. There's so much fun stuff going on. Apparently, the bravest person in this group at this moment is Toto, who is barking. And the lion goes, well, I can intimidate this little one. And going after Toto was the wrong move for the Cowardly Lion, because that gets Dorothy mad.
Listen, have you ever had a small dog? Small dogs don't care about the size of other dogs.
I've seen it.
I've had
the big dog with the small dog barking at it.
Yeah. And so it's just you know that kind of stuff. So it makes sense that Toto to defend Dorothy from a danger that he senses instinctively as a dog, as an animal, goes and barks at the lion, and the lion chases the dog, and then Dorothy slaps him on the nose.
Shame on you.
What did you do that for? I didn't buy them.
No, but you tried to. It's bad enough picking on a straw man, but when you go around picking on poor little dogs.
Well, you didn't have to go and hit me, did you?
the turns of Bert Lahr from bluster to fear is just, they're great.
Yeah.
And Dorothy, and if you watch Judy Garland carefully, in this moment, you can see her right on the edge of breaking.
My goodness, what a fuss you're making.
Several things about this. She did break multiple times on this and start laughing on this. And she's working with three vaudeville guys.
Yeah.
If you hang out with vaudeville, I mean, I've never actually hung out with vaudeville guys, but I've hung out with theater guys and I've hung out with guys that think they're funny. And there are people that are like, our friend Mike Ross can be this way sometimes. If you start laughing at a thing, he will not quit. He will continue to come at with that thing and just crack you up. And there was nothing more fun for these three vaudeville actors than cracking up Judy Garland.
I'm sure.
The problem is...
I'm sure they immediately loved her. And probably became like uncles to her, I would say. And, you know, like, and probably saw the way she was being treated by a stage mom and wanted to make the experience as easy as possible.
I mean, she stayed friends with most of them for a long time. Yeah.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. When Judy Garland broke, it shuts down the movie.
Yeah, right.
This is a money question. This isn't just a, hey, we're all having fun on the set thing. And at one point, Victor Fleming was so concerned about the time that they were wasting that he pulled Judy Garland aside, brought her to behind the set where it was private, told her that this was very serious and she needed to take it seriously, and then he slapped her in the face.
Oh, Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
We'll never know fully how horrible people were to performers during that time, especially young female performers during that time. And I wonder if we ever got a chance to really see what happened behind the scenes. Why doesn't Ken Burns do a documentary in Hollywood? Let's go deep into
that. Oh my God. Ken Burns is Hollywood?
Ken Burns is Hollywood. Holy shit. Amazing. I mean, amazing. And some of these people are still alive and some of these stories that could be told might make the blood curdle, but there would be lawsuits galore coming out of that thing. But it would be amazing, Steve.
I'll take this one step further. John Rocha and Steve Morris will volunteer to do some of the voices in Ken Burns' Hollywood.
Not volunteer and not get paid.
Sorry, not volunteer. Yes, you should pay us. Forgive me. Yes.
Easy, so, kid. I want to get paid. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Let me tell you how I heard this story, and there is more to this story,
okay,
which is that, you know, because I'm watching all these behind-the-scene things and documentary stuff like that,
and
there's a documentary that has footage of Victor Fleming, looked like maybe it was shot in the 50s or 60s, and his original assistant director. And it's the original assistant director that told this story with Victor Fleming sitting next to him. And then he says that the Victor came back to the set and sat down in his director's chair. And Victor Fleming, by the way, had been, I think I'd mentioned, had been a stuntman, and he had a broken nose. So he had kind of a misaligned nose. And says, I should say, by the way, that Dorothy went back and nailed it in the next scene perfectly. So the AD said, oh, I guess, you know, that was what had to happen. And Fleming turned to the AD and said, I wish she had hit me in the nose and broken it again. AD says, why? And he says, because of what I just had to do.
Oh.
And then, but that's not the end of the story, because according to the AD, Fleming didn't know that Judy Garland was standing right behind him when he said that.
Oof.
And she walked up and said, I wouldn't hit you in the nose, Mr. Fleming, but I'll kiss you, and kissed him on the broken nose.
Oh.
Now, these are the stories of Hollywood.
Yep.
You know, and here we have this story that we're hearing framed by Victor Fleming, framed by the AD, not framed by Judy Garland. I don't know if it happened or didn't happen or what it meant or what she felt at this moment or how she feels about it. I don't know anything about that. But these are the stories you get, you know?
Yeah, yeah. That's why I think that film with Renee Zellweger on Judy Garland was really fantastic. I mean, because it showed you that she was a complex person. She was so incredibly nice, but then she had a fierce defense of her abilities as a performer, combined with a massive insecurity about them, you know? So this was all constructed from a young age, having a stage mom like this. But she was such a sweetheart. And there's stories galore about how much of a sweetheart she was. But then there were moments where she could really be a taskmaster in the things that she wanted to have done, you know? And so it's a very interesting, she's a very interesting human being when you read the stuff that you read on Judy Garland and how she handled all of this stuff and what she was put through, you know? Her and Marilyn, just there's just so much to explore with those two. Because it seems like they were genuinely nice people, but who were definitely taken advantage of by people in power in Hollywood in really tough ways.
I'll give you a few more details. So, yeah. So as I mentioned again, Judy Garland is competing against some of the most beautiful classic Hollywood right. women in the world, and she doesn't fit that bill. So the studio from the beginning is pressuring her to lose weight.
Of course.
They bound her chest to make it smaller. Oof. And then to keep her weight down, they start giving her amphetamines. So she's yep. been given Benzedrine. They don't like the shape of her teeth. So throughout this film, she's wearing false teeth. They also don't like the shape of her nose. So there is a rubber disc in each one of her nostrils what? to fill out her nose. She wore those for the next 5 years.
Jesus.
Yep. Because she also claims to have been groped by Louis B. Mayer when yep. she would go to the commissary. She, whatever she'd order, they'd bring her a cup of chicken soup and black coffee. The commissary had standing orders not to feed her whatever she wanted. Jesus. Again, she's on uppers to keep her appetite down and keep her energy up, but then she couldn't sleep, so they give her downers to get her to Ugh. Sleep. And here's, you want to know one of the side effects of the drugs that she was on the set? They made her giggle. And the whole reason she got slapped was because she kept ruining takes.
Right. Right.
Now, I don't know that it was the drugs specifically in that moment that had this thing, but I just say the whole situation is so terrible. Yeah. You know, this 16-year-old girl who's holding the whole movie together and gives right. One of the great musical performances, period. You know, yep. and it sucks.
Yeah, agreed. I guarantee you they weren't treating Ariana like that on the set of Wicked. I'll tell you that right now.
Why, you're nothing but a great big coward.
You're right. I am a coward. I haven't any courage at all. I even scare myself. Look at the cycles under my eyes. I haven't slept in weeks.
Why don't you try counting sheep?
That doesn't do any good. I'm afraid of them.
It's great. Everything he does is so much fun.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, it's not like this is some great mystery. We're going to go take him to see the wizard.
Wouldn't you feel degraded to be seen in the company of a cowardly lion? I would.
Oh, of course not.
And they accept him. And again, yeah. this is one of the keys to this movie, is you have these weird outsiders that aren't outsiders now that they're all together.
Yeah, it's sad, believe me, missy, when you're born to be a sissy without the feminine vibe. But I could show my prowess, be a lion, not a mouse, if I only had the nerve.
A mouse is another example of it doesn't quite fit the scan right, so this time yeah. I'm adding an extra syllable to make it work. I do like lines like, I'm afraid there's no denying. I'm just a dandelion.
A fate I don't deserve.
What's nice about the song is that it kind of rolls us right into them all being together.
I'd be brave as a blizzard.
I'd be gentle as a lizard.
I'd be clever as a gizzard.
If the wizard is a wizard, who will serve?
Are gizzards clever?
I don't know.
I don't think so.
Isn't gizzard am I wrong on this? I thought the gizzard was a neck of a chicken. Am I wrong on that? What is a gizzard?
It's a, you know what? We should know the answer to this question. It is definitely in the little bag of stuff when you get your chicken or a turkey. Yeah. The gizzard is in there.
Okay.
But I don't know what it's, I always thought it was sort of a internal organ kind of thing.
Yeah, it's a muscular, thick-walled part of a bird's stomach for grinding food, typically with grit.
There you go.
How is that clever? Is that a slang word?
No, it just right because he doesn't care. He doesn't. The lyrics just doesn't care.
All right.
And plus, you know, the scarecrow doesn't have a brain, so maybe he thinks that gizzards are clever at this point.
Oh, good point. Good point.
Then I'm sure to get a brain, a heart,
a home,
the knife.
The moment in the middle where Dorothy sings that part, if the wizard is a wizard, and then Judy hits it right. Who can? I love that switch in the song. Because yeah. we're going along, and then Judy hits us with that banger moment, and then we go back to the comedic responses of the three guys. But I love that she makes that little change, or the construction of the song has that little change in it to show a little more magnificence to the song than you might have anticipated. You know?
And then we're off to see the wizard.
Yeah, let's go.
By the way, so particularly when the four of them are all going together and skipping, I mean, you know, these are three adult men and one teen girl,
right.
and they just tended to squeeze her out. So it would end up being the three guys in front and her a half step behind trying to get back in. Oh. And this became a big sort of, again, a conflict on the set of like, you have to let Dorothy in. You have to keep her in. It's hard to do. I understand this.
Performers center stage.
Yeah, exactly. I need to bring up a topic that maybe some people won't like us going into, but
okay.
I think it's really important to discuss, which is that there is a tremendous connection between the film The Wizard of Oz and the gay mm-hmm. community. And I think that a lot of this, particularly in the Courage song from The Lion, there are all sorts of things in there that are why this is the case. And in no way am I saying that The Wizard of Oz is a gay-coded movie intentionally, that was something that had some message, or that any of these characters are gay. I'm not saying that. Mm. But I am saying that for the gay community, for, you know, 50 plus years after this film and longer, this movie has been a touch point for a lot of reasons.
Yeah, they co-opted the experiences in the movie to mirror the experiences that they go through in our society, in all societies, not just our American society, all societies. And I think the Polynesian culture is much more accepting from what I think I remember. But that's why Judy Garland also became such a massive person in the gay community, right? Barbra Streisand, Judy Garland, they're just these performers that have this, they are just immediately become icons for the gay community. And Judy was one of them for sure. You know, and she was always very, from what I remember, very appreciative of the gay community supporting her throughout her life, you know? So it was always there. And I'm not surprised, you know, and I don't think there's anything wrong with a community seeing a movie in a certain way and finding connection to it because of the things that they experience in mass in our society.
I think in particular in the era of, you know, where it was illegal to be gay in this country and people were in the closet, there was a lot that The Wizard of Oz said. And one of the big things is playing with gender roles, what is masculine and what is feminine, has been a touchstone of comedy probably since we were standing around the fire in the cave.
Yes. You know? Right.
Like, and ideas of drag and the masculine woman or the feminine man are classic tropes going back to Commedia dell'arte and Shakespeare and absolutely in vaudeville where these guys were from, you know. And so when you watch the Lion's performance, there's unquestionably an exploration of masculinity.
Yeah.
He's saying, I want the masculine quality of courage.
Right.
But he's displaying all these preening, vain sort of, you know, behaviors that mix the masculine and the feminine. And that is where the comedy is coming from. And if you're a gay man in 1953 in Wisconsin and you're concerned about presenting a veneer of masculinity so you don't get found out, you're looking at the Cowardly Lion, you know?
Yeah.
Like the Cowardly Lion becomes a real symbol of that. And all of these guys are outsiders. They're weirdos. Yeah. They're freaks. And this is, you think about all of these, you know, all these people in the United States whose love was literally illegal. And they were maybe interested in opera and art and other things that were tended to be viewed more femininely. And so the idea of how do you have your identity but present properly in society becomes a big thing. And this is why, I mean, one of the main code words for finding out if someone was gay was, are you a friend of Dorothy?
Oh, wow.
Oh,
I
yeah.
I didn't know that.
Friends of Dorothy, man.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is going to be the name of my fantasy football team next year. Just for shits and giggles. I love that. Friends of Dorothy. I love that. That's great.
Yeah. Literally, it was a code word.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is something I struggle with personally my whole life because I was not your standard typical dude growing up, yet I was surrounded by, especially in Southern Virginia, by a lot of the sons of the hillbillies and the sons of the rednecks and the Southern guys. And I was a guy who was into musicals. I was a guy who was into soft rock. I was a kid who was into Shakespeare. And so I was very ostracized in my mind growing up because into musicals, into stuff like that. Like I liked Barbra Streisand at a young age, you know, but I wasn't gay. I was very straight, always been straight or cis, whatever you want to use. And so For me, this is something I struggled with for a very long time, and it developed into a very deep self-hatred, which is, I think, one of the elements that led to my near suicide in 2016, is this kind of rejection of who I was as a person and not finding value in myself. And so saying like, well, I have nothing to offer clearly to anyone of who I want to be with in a relationship. And there's a lot of things wrong with me because I've been told by society that I don't fit into this thing. Even in the military, when I achieved the things that I achieved in the military, and I, you know, adapted a stronger personality, embraced self-discipline and all of that, and muscles and working out, all that, you know, I still felt inadequate with a lot of relationships because the women I would date would see one thing. And then when they saw how much of a softer person I was and sentimental person I was, it kind of turned them off. And so I struggled with that for a very long time in my life. And so when you talk about this stuff, I'm not gay, but I have a connection to the experience of like a light connection to the experience of being gay in this society that preaches overt masculinity, which is of course a fallacy on so many levels, but we're not going to get into that because there's so many holes you can poke in that nonsense. But there is that feeling that if you don't convey a certain thing, then you're considered to be less than a man. And that is a frustrating thing. And I still deal with it now in the YouTube comment sections with some videos because of some things I say, but of course I'm much more comfortable in my skin than I ever was before. And so, you know, I understand why people would connect to that, you know, and relate to that. Maybe it's instinctually and subconsciously. The reason I love the line as much as I do, even though he's not my favorite, is because of what he goes through in the movie, you know?
I think those are great points. And I think it points to really the universality, particularly for kids, of this story, because at the age that kids are discovering The Wizard of Oz is the age where adults are telling them what they're supposed to be and how they're supposed to behave and what, exactly. You know,
yeah.
And they're trying to do that thing. It's funny. My story is really similar to yours, is that because I was into musicals and acting and theatrical things, and I was very imaginative as a kid. And I used to do performances for relatives that I was the kid. It's like, Steve, get up 100%. And do a song. And so I would do all that stuff. And I would do Alan Sherman songs and Tom Lehrer songs and things like that. And I started to hear two things happened. One is I started to hear, you know, where did Steve get his creativity from? There's no one creative in our family. Oh, except Uncle Walter. I heard these stories about Uncle Walter, who died long before I was born. Right. I just heard, oh yeah, he reminds us of Uncle Walter. Put that on the back burner for a moment. Then there was one day, and I think I was 11, I had a big stuffed animal collection on my bed, and my great uncle Bob, who we called Big Bob because his son was Little Bobby. So yeah. Big Bob came over, looked in my room, saw the stuffed animals and said, I thought he was a boy. What's he doing with all these stuffed animals?
Yeah. That ignorant shit, man. Sorry.
The next day I cleared my stuffed animals off my bed.
Yep. You know? Of course, because you wanted to be accepted. Yeah.
And then I finally saw in high school, I saw a picture of Uncle Walter. Mm. Uncle Walter was the gay uncle.
Oh,
is so clearly, and he was a closeted gay man in the San Francisco in the, you know, 40s. And there's the one picture I have, which I'll send to you. He's wearing an ascot, you know, like it's so, you could so see. And I was like, oh, they associated creativity and stuffed animals with being feminine and therefore not being a man, you know?
It's still in our society today. Our political rhetoric is littered with stuff like that. The barista, soy boy, the artsy fartsy crowd, or the California people, you know, our political discourse is filled with that nonsense. That the idea if you're remotely into the arts, then you're somehow not masculine, right? And I don't want to go too deep in this, but even what we see going on at the Kennedy Center, right? We're taking over the Kennedy Center to put real masculine plays on there. And it's like, come on, man. So it's a shame that we have to deal with this knuckle-dragging, caveman-esque approach to masculinity still in our society, when we could be advancing as human beings and more enlightened human beings in our society. But there's just such a large section that wants to keep us back to the knuckle-dragging days. And it's so frustrating because I think it's actually what is keeping us from becoming a more enlightened society and becoming a more advanced society is this desire, is this fear this, because I don't think these people, just like the Cowardly Lion, have the courage to walk into a future where they don't have to hold on to these archaic stereotypes of supposed masculinity and supposed strength. Because 9 times out of 10, that approach to the light, to the world, leads to death, multiple thousands to millions of lives being killed, being murdered, and rarely leads to anything that is overtly positive, you know? So
I know we're on a digression here, but I'm going to digress further now.
Okay.
Because I actually think this is really important, because I think part of what's happening, and I think it's definitely true with the Cowardly Lion, is it's how you define courage. Is
right.
The definition in living in the Cowardly Lion's mind is a very traditionally masculine, dominant sort of courage.
Right.
I might have told this story on the show before, I don't remember, but as I've said many times, Hoover, my partner on the Shark shows, had spent a lot of time in Afghanistan during the war against the Soviets. Right. And one of the problems they had when the CIA was first trying to train the Mujahideen to fight this insurgent war against the Soviets, which is interesting because those are the same people that fought an insurgent war against us and we had trained them how to do it. But putting that aside, one of the problems that they had is when the soldiers, when the Mujahideen would go into battle, they would go in standing up, because the concept of courage, which I think the term in Pashtun is herat, or maybe that might just be honor. But the basic conception of it is that any display of fear or self-preservation would be shown as weak. And therefore, even if they're in the middle of battle and guns are blazing, to duck would be displaying a lack of masculine courage.
Wow.
And so they had to convince them, like, no, this is not how you can fight a war against tanks. You can't just walk in. That's not going to work. And when I started to think, this is the phrase from Pashtun that really, really struck me, is that Hoover at one point said, well, how do you define courage? And they said in the Afghani tradition that courage is doing that which is hardest, which I think is a really interesting definition of courage.
Yeah.
And these guys would never admit weakness. They would never admit they were hurt. They would be an extremely masculine society.
Right.
And I remembered I was around Hoover right when my dad got sick. And I remember when I first had to tell people about my dad's illness.
Yeah.
And I didn't cry when I heard that he was going to die. It was when I had to tell people.
Right.
And I started thinking about this idea of, wait, what is hardest? What is doing what is hardest? Sometimes admitting weakness or fear is what's hardest.
Of course.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, and this was the big change, is like, and that's why I go, in a weird way, the lion is an exploration of masculinity.
Yeah.
He has an image in his head that I should not be afraid. And that is what courage is. Courage isn't necessarily not being afraid.
Right.
Overcoming fear is courage, you know?
Well, what is it? Courage is feeling the fear and doing it anyway.
Yeah.
That's how I look at it. Yeah.
I mean, it's like, you know, it makes sense to mention it in the part one of Wicked, at the dance scene. There is a moment where the character of Elphaba displays way more courage than anybody else in that movie by dancing in a room. It's not like masculine courage. It is, you are an outsider and she chooses to be herself, you know?
Right.
That was a super long digression. We are still off to see the wizard. The Wicked Witch is looking at the crystal ball with her flying monkey, which, by the way, is a guy named Pat Walsh, who is world famous, maybe not world famous, for playing animals in vaudeville and film and all sorts of stuff. He made a whole living at this.
Now, my beauty, something with poison in it, I think. With poison in it, but attractive to the eye and soothing the smell. Poppies will put them to sleep.
In the book, poppies are just an accident. They just happen to run into them. They're not sent by the wizard. Okay. But we end up, we have this hill of poppies.
There's Emerald City. Oh, we're almost there at last. It's beautiful, isn't it?
Well, come on, Em. What are we waiting for?
Nothing. Let's hurry.
Yes, let's run.
And they all head off, running across the poppies. And at first they're skipping, and then slowly but surely the lion and Dorothy slow down.
They just want to get 40 winks.
I remember, I think I was in high school, where someone told me, you know those poppies, it's a reference of opium, right, man? You know it's about opium. And I went, I guess it is.
Yeah.
It kind of is.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, the poppies are not affecting the Tin Man and the Scarecrow because they don't have lungs. But Dorothy and the Lion are going down. The shot of Toto asleep on the ground always is very upsetting, I think.
Help! Help! It's no use screaming at a time like this. Nobody will hear you. Help! Help! Help!
And then Glinda shows up and it starts snowing.
Yeah, Glinda. Well, thanks for showing up, Glinda. Again, Steve, to reiterate your point from earlier, the Scarecrow takes over.
Yeah.
Right? In this moment, he's like, stop crying because you're going to rust yourself. And Dorothy and the Lion, he's like, you guys got to wake up. You guys, you can't do this right now. We're going to get in. We're so close. You know. So basically, he sees that there is a vacuum in leadership. And this is the guy who said, I won't try to take over. I won't try to do anything. Just take me with you. But he does, because this is his natural instinct. Because he does have a brain, he understands what the situation is and what needs to happen. And he's trying to, you know, make sure everybody can get on the same page here so they can get out of the situation. And then thankfully, Glinda shows up and you know, peppers everybody with snow, wakes them up.
The snow, remember I told you there was a very successful stage musical of The Wizard of Oz?
Yes.
That had a whole bunch of weird stuff in it that's not in the book? The snow is the solution of the poppies from the stage show. So that's where this comes from.
Oh, that's
and funny. Yeah. Would you like to know what the snow is made of? It's
sure.
Very safety conscious and you're not going to have any problems with it at all.
Asbestos?
It's asbestos.
No surprise. No fucking surprise. Yeah.
The Emerald City is faster than lightning.
I love, she just jumps out the window and then there's that miniature that flies away for her. Totally fun.
Agreed.
We've arrived at the Emerald City.
Yeah.
We ring the big doorbell and the door opens up and there is Frank Morgan, the Wizard of Oz. Except this is my question, John.
Okay.
Is this the Wizard of Oz or is this Frank Morgan playing a different part?
Oh, I think it's the wizard who plays all the parts. I think it's absolutely the wizard who, I mean, why would he trust anybody else to keep the lie going but himself? And so I think he dons these costumes at different times throughout their visit to Oz, so to Emerald City. So yes, I think it's the wizard playing all of these characters.
I'm going to ask you another question before I give my answer, but
okay.
When do you think as a kid, you totally recognized this as the same actor throughout? Or so, was there some point at which you figured it out?
Okay, it was on November 17th of 2025 that I realized that it was Frank Morgan playing all of these characters.
Really?
Yeah, no, honestly, 100%. I knew it was Frank Morgan as the wizard, obviously, as the guy at the beginning and all of that. But I did not know Frank played the guard, nor did I know that Frank played the guy who was about to lead them in the carriage. I had no idea that was him. So this was a revelation to me that I just went, of course, because I love Frank in the film. It makes sense that he would be playing these roles and do such a great job and make them uniquely different from the other roles. You know, every role is uniquely different. And it's so you could see it if you knew it, but if you didn't know it, you could easily not think or easily think these are different actors.
So I never noticed as a kid, ever.
Yeah.
Never even occurred to me or popped in my brain in any way.
Right.
I think it might have been in film school or something. Like it would that someone pointed it out to me.
Right, right.
And here's the thing. So first of all, we have this weird thing where you and I, who've seen the movie many, many times, know the movie really, really well, did not notice this. My guess is many people, maybe half of people, maybe more, do not notice that this is the same actor playing.
Oh, 100%. So, I would argue. Yeah.
So, and then I don't think this movie makes any sense whatsoever if it is the wizard in each of these roles. Because
why?
The behavior, we'll go through it.
Okay.
We'll go through it. It's pretty weird. I mean, frankly, Frank Morgan playing the wizard, frankly, the wizard makes no sense. Like, it's just so bizarre as we go along, why the wizard is doing what they're doing. It's all over the place.
Right.
That's, again, I am not criticizing The Wizard of Oz. I'm just saying, some movies you don't want to think about too much.
Who rang that bell?
We did.
Can't you read?
Read what?
The notice.
And he looks around and there's no notice. Then he goes back inside, comes back out, put a sign on the door, closes the door. The door says, "Bell out of order, please knock." It's a long way to go for a joke, but it's very satisfying, I think.
Only works.
But nobody can see the Great Oz. Nobody's ever seen the Great Oz. Even I've never seen him.
Well, then how do you know there is one?
All very fun.
Yeah.
And then we mentioned the Good Witch of the North who sent them and that she's wearing the ruby slippers. And he sees the slippers and goes,
"Oh, so she is. Well, bust my buttons. Why didn't you say that in the first place? That's a horse of a different color. Come on in."
So if this is the wizard, at this point,
yes,
why has he let them in?
Because she has the slippers.
So he wants the slippers.
He does, yeah.
Okay.
He knows what the slippers symbolize. And I think he knows the slippers keep the witch away.
Okay.
Right. By the way, the Lord of Oz, yeah.
So would you like to know how you go into the Emerald City in the book, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz?
Sure.
There's a law passed by the wizard, a royal decree, if you will, that all citizens must wear green spectacles. So before you're allowed to go in, you are fitted with special green spectacles with green lenses that are locked onto your face and cannot be removed for the duration of your stay in the Emerald City.
Right.
Because the inside of the Emerald City is not green.
Right.
It only appears green to everybody because they have to wear green spectacles, which is a law created by the wizard.
Right.
I think that is hilarious.
I think it makes all the sense in the world. Because I think the wizard is a commentary on God, on religion. And the idea, if you go through the book, through what you just presented, Steve, you have to believe this stuff so that you can see what we're doing through this prism. And you can see what it is through this prism. So it's simply, something that's the color green, you could argue it's like this philosophy or this point of view. We have to affix this thing. And I don't mean physically put glasses on you. I mean mentally. Have you believe this ideology so that you see the emerald green, so that the Emerald City is green, which is that you believe our ideology. If you use it from the movie, it makes all the sense in the world that Oz is, in essence, God, this idea of what is really going on. How much faith do you have in this thing? Can you really get what you need from God? Do you even need God? Because it's always been inside you from the beginning. So I like this as a possible conversation or philosophical debate on what the wizard symbolizes. And so as I've got, obviously I didn't think that when I was fucking 8 years old, but like, as I'm older now, I kind of see that as a talking point. And I enjoy that, exploring that, which is why I think the wizard plays all the roles, because like a lot of people who are in charge of religion or theology or a doctrine, they want to be the only ones that control how it's perceived, how it's presented, who gets in, who doesn't get in, and who believes what. And what they believe, you know, and they want to control it all. So
it's funny. I think that makes perfect sense. And it was always the government. It was always the
absolutely
politicians.
For sure.
They're telling you a story. And like, and again, you know, everyone gets mad when we get political. I promise I'm saying something entirely both sides, which is that we have had two presidents in a row who both are currently trying to convince the American people that the economy is much better than it is, you know, and they're saying, you know, that's Biden and Trump. It's not a political thing. Both of them are saying, no, things are really great. I just keep telling you that things are really great. So you believe me and I don't get in trouble, you know.
Ho, 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 and a couple of tra-la-las. That's how we laugh a day away in the very old land of Oz.
So they go inside. I love the sets of the Emerald City. Oh. Like the costumes are great. The whole look of the environment's fantastic. And we call over the cabbie, which again is played by the wizard or the actor, depending. Oh, yeah. And we'd seen this horse that's green, and now the horse is suddenly purple. By the way, they dyed the horse using vegetable oil and jello powder. Wow. And they just, which flavor? So now we're on the grape jello is what the horse is wearing now.
What kind of a horse is that? I've never seen a horse like that before.
No, and never will again, I fancy. There's only one of him, and he's it. He's the horse of a different color you've heard tell about.
You know, both this and the door joke are like, you took a long time to get to the joke. I mean, you put a lot of effort into this, but I do think they're worth it.
Yeah, agreed.
And then we go into just a lovely song, which is The Merry Old Land of Oz.
That's how we laugh the day away with a ho-ho-ho. The Merry Old Land of Oz.
Again, this is what... So on the one hand, the wizard is a con man.
Yes.
He's not a wizard. Understood. He's lying to his people. He's gaslighting them in all sorts of ways.
Yep.
Except... the people in Emerald City are genuinely happy.
Yes.
He is a great ruler on some level.
What? No. I don't want to say no to you, Steve, in terms of like pushing back.
Actually, you're right. I'm going to stick with on some level. There's some issues with the Wizard of Oz. But in general, he's a great leader.
People who have bought into the cult leader say... yes, everything they're doing is great because I believe the philosophy. You've affixed the green lenses onto my eyes and everything is green in Emerald City. So yes, it's amazing. It's all amazing because we buy into the cult or into the religion or into the government, whatever it may be. So yeah, that's the way I look at
it. Well, yeah, but here's where I agree that it is a cult, particularly if you're locking green spectacles on people's heads.
Yeah.
From all the evidence presented in the film, yes. Emerald City as a society, an economy, it works. It's not, in other words, like we don't see any evidence that there's covering up like homeless people that they're pushing aside in the Emerald City. Emerald City seems like a really happy place. So Oz is a good leader on some levels. And
if you take what you're presented in the movie, yes.
Right. I don't know of anything else I'm not seeing.
Right.
Well, just to your religion point.
Yeah.
There is something that feels really good about believing in the wizard.
Of course.
You know,
right.
That brings a society together.
It's one less thing I have to worry about if I just believe him. But of course, that's what ends up leading to the wizard doing more and more things that are a bit questionable. And I don't know how the books go. I haven't read the L. Frank Baum books go. Does the wizard appear over and over again? Or is there no wizard?
Oh, yeah. They all come back.
Yeah.
There's so many, because what kept happening with the books, so he wrote the first set of books and then had to sell the rights to him because he had gone bankrupt. And then he kept trying to write other adult books and all this other stuff. Nobody would buy anything from him. He wrote under pseudonyms. They wanted Oz books. And so he kept, like at the end, The Wizard of Oz wasn't supposed to have a sequel, but people wanted a sequel. So it kept being like, how does Dorothy get back to Oz? Or how do these other people, eventually she brings Aunt Em and Uncle Henry to Oz. But every time it's like, well, we can't do the balloon again. Oh, now we've dug a tunnel. Now they built a radio that talked to Kansas, to Oz at one point. I mean, there's just like, it's just, you know, it's the same thing we see with like Star Wars things. It's like, how do we do the same thing again and get this all started again without quite making it look like we're just doing the same thing again?
How do I convince B.A. Baracus to get on this plane one more time for this episode?
Exactly.
A-team.
That's a deep cut. But Mad Dog Murdoch, is that his name? Mad Dog?
Yeah,
something like that.
Mad Dog Murdoch, yeah.
Yeah, he could get him going.
Yeah, of course.
Let's see. And then I love the sequence of them all getting gussied up with this, you know, Scarecrow getting new straw and the Tin Man getting polished up and a nice makeover for Dorothy. But it's really the lion getting gussied. That's just because he loves it. He loves every moment of it.
His curls are amazing.
Incredible.
And ribbons. So good.
And then we hear a noise and it's the Wicked Witch who's out skywriting with her broom, Surrender Dorothy. So they had set up some shots. There's some miniatures, and then there's also someone on a broom, and the broom has a smoker, and it has a thing that kind of like, you know, it's like the rocket on the back of the Batmobile or something.
Oh, yeah.
Like a little bit of flame and then smoke. Right. And so they wanted Margaret Hamilton to get on this broom to do the shot from behind when they do a lot of the real flame.
Okay.
And she had just had an issue where she had literally been lit on fire.
Oh, yeah,
and
right.
She said... Yeah, when she'd popped out, when she'd gone back down in Munchkin Land.
Right.
And so she said, yeah, I'm not going to do that. And they really tried to push her, and they really tried to push her, and they said, it's perfectly safe. We've tested the whole thing out. And she held strong, and she wouldn't do it.
Good.
And they used her stand-in, and they went to do it, and the broom blew up, sending the stand-in to the hospital.
Jesus Christ!
Yep.
Morons!
I mean, well, again, it's like... The movies hadn't been around that long, you know, like this is, you know, today we've worked a lot of this stuff out. And then this is the Wild West.
That's true.
As the citizens of Oz in a blind panic, and Dorothy and her companions see their true enemy for the first time. I think this, John, is the time to end part two of our exploration of the Wizard of Oz.
What a cliffhanger. But I do want to say that I think this is an amazing situation with the Wicked Witch. She is just toying with everybody. What's that line in Swingers? It's like they're all bunny rabbits, and she's playing. She's got bear paws, and she's playing with Oz's citizens. She clearly is not intimidated by the wizard, nor is she intimidated by Dorothy or the Tin Man. Like, she's just loving playing with her food before she gets to it. So ending this way and announcing herself in such a powerful way, I think, is super interesting. And getting closer and closer to the confrontation with Dorothy that we're going to get to in the next part. But I like this as a kind of fearsome ending for this part, but also fearsome ending to this section of the film, having her announce her plans to get Dorothy to surrender.
You know what just occurred to me now? I mean, it's kind of occurred to me before because, of course, of Wicked that explores this so much, but never quite in this way, which is I suddenly went, wait, does the Wicked Witch of the West in The Wizard of Oz know that the wizard is a fraud?
I have to believe she does. And certainly we discover that in Wicked. But like this film, it seems very clear that she's not intimidated by the wizard at all in any way, shape, or form. And this is her way, again, of toying with him and messing with him, because maybe she likes the balance that has been established by this fake, because it's really Glinda who she's intimidated by.
I'm thinking about this. I think this is a good one since we're ending right here. This is a great question to ask of our listeners. Yeah. If you want to visit us on our Facebook page, you can do a search for The Cinephiles. If you have opinions, if you want to go on Twitter or X, it's @Cine_Files. It's The Cinephiles Podcast on Instagram. And of course, if you haven't subscribed to the show, there are many, many places to do it. You have a wide range of podcast subscription options. The Cinephiles, I believe, is on all of them. If you like to write reviews, write a review for us. If you want to give us a comment, we love reading. We'll try to get back to you. And if you want to buy or stream The Wizard of Oz, along with every other film we've ever reviewed, it's on cinephiles.net. And you can reach me, and of course, patreon.com/thecinephiles or Apple Podcast to support the show. And you can reach me at SR Morris on Twitter, SR Morris 1 on Instagram. John, how about you?
Yeah, you can always reach me at The Roca Says on all social media platforms, and head on over to my YouTube channel at youtube.com/John Roca Says for all the shows we do there, like The Geek Buddies and The Hot Mic and Spill the Tequila and everything we're going on there as well.
And I think that's it for this week. We will be back in Oz next week to conclude our exploration of this incredible film right here on The Cinephiles.